Okay, good morning to everybody, and I want to say a very public thank you to Lloyd Atkinson for filling in for me last week. I called him this week to tell him he wouldn't have to work for me next week, but those are things that you don't normally see. He had a house full of grandchildren, so I think he was actually grateful for the release. There has been a rescheduling of things in Florida, so I have no idea what my schedule will be for the next little while. There may come a Sunday when I'm not here and nobody else is here either, in which case you are on your own. My suggestion is to use it for a Quaker morning, and you have done that before. There are faces in the room that I wasn't expecting to see this morning, but we said there weren't any visitors, so I'll assume there weren't. But welcome to all of you. Now, we have been looking for a bit over a year, maybe a year and a half, at lists in the Bible. And we had started a new one the last time you and I were together. And I don't think I told you clearly where this one came from, so I need to do that this morning. If you take the King James Version of the Bible and you look for the word servant, the word appears 14 times in the New Testament associated with an adjective or a descriptor of some kind. And I'm stealing from the book The Mind of Christ by T.W. Hunt and Claude King in working out some of this. But in essence, each of those terms or descriptors of servanthood should apply to us because that's what we're called to be. And in that process, T.W. Hunt points out that as we acquire one of these characteristics, that frees God to do things in our lives and in the lives of people around us. And so that's what we're looking at. Now, it's pop quiz time. Those of you who were not here 2 weeks ago, you're off the hook. But let's see how the rest of you do. I'm also told, I think I had not remembered this, and I should have said this during the prayer time. Janie McDorman is scheduled for cataract surgery sometime right in here, and we didn't mention that. But normally I expect her to be here with notes. Kitty, I think you're the one that we may have to all look to lead us on this. Kitty and Janie usually keep pretty good notes on things like this. But there's an adjective, and there's an attitude, and there is a frees God to do something in our lives. And we have looked so far at two of these. We managed to do two weeks ago. We still have 12 to go. We'll see how it goes. So, who remembers these two that we did? Okay. Humble or humility. What was the attitude that was involved with that one? You remember? This one was a little subtle. We started off with a hard one, yeah? Just say it again.
Doing God's work for others. Is that getting all
supposed? Not quite. Almost, but not quite. It's recognizing that God is at work in others and recognizing that it's not just me. That God is working in other people, and it gives us a proper attitude towards God's work in others. And what does that free God to do? Now, let me help you with this one because it was important enough. This is the one that took us into Isaiah 57, and that meant we had to do a little detour for most of the time. Okay, but Isaiah 57, if you'll take a look at verse 15. Isaiah 57, verse 15. While you're looking at that, let me just interject. I would like for everybody in the room to take on a New Year's resolution. Can you do that? I'm realizing in my old age I'm forgetting things that I know so well that I can't possibly have forgotten them, but I still do. Can you find your name tag and wear it just to help me? And if you don't have a name tag, can you see Barbara and let her know that you need one? We'll try to get you one. Can you all do that? This set of cabinets over here, that's where this hour usually hangs their name tags. And so if you could do that, that would help me. It would make me pretend to remember your name when in fact maybe I didn't. Isaiah 57 verse 15, back to this. This is what the high and exalted one who lives eternally and whose name is holy says. I live in the holy heights, but I am with the contrite and the humble, to revive the spirit of the humble, to revive the heart of the contrite. This allows God to manifest himself, to reveal himself. We get a glimpse of God's presence if this particular characteristic is there. And I think part of that, it helps me to see that if I can see what God is doing in other people, maybe I can begin to recognize God's presence in my own life in a way that otherwise I wouldn't. What was the second one?
Understanding.
That was the attitude.
Obedience.
Very good. Obedience is the adjective, and understanding God's authority was the attitude that came with it. And that frees God to do what? Slightly different. We went to Judges 7. Do you remember the story in Judges 7? Remember who was the focus person? Gideon. There was a battle that was about to take place. God said to Gideon, I'm sorry, you've got too many soldiers to win this battle. I've been listening to, as I drive back and forth to work, a story about Lincoln and his cabinet. His cabinet was the central people in his cabinet were the people who were his rivals for the nomination for the presidency. And all of them thought themselves to be stronger and better people than he was and what he did to mold them in. But he told the story of McClellan. I once briefly was in the Army and I once briefly trained at Fort McClellan. McClellan had the biggest and most powerful army, but he kept thinking they weren't big enough. And so he kept not fighting, because he just didn't have an army big enough to do whatever he needed to do. And then they would suddenly find out that the opposing army that the South had was not nearly as strong as he had thought, and if he had just attacked, things would have happened. But here's God saying to Gideon, your army's too big for you to win the battle. How many people did he have at that first moment? Do you remember? Those of you who weren't here, this is sort of the fun part. 30,000, okay? He said, you got to group that down. So he said, tell the people that are scared to go home. How many people would be scared just before they went into battle? Most of them. So my suspicion is some of them were probably not being as truthful as they could be. But anyway, he ended up at that point with 10,000, and God said, that's still too many. You can't win a victory with that many people. You have to have fewer. And he ended up with how many? 300. And he won the battle. Why did that happen? So that at the end of the day, the people would say, this was God's work. This wasn't ours. Obedience, understanding God's authority, frees God to do mighty things. In our presence, things that we can see as he does them. Okay? So, we're going to now look at some others. Now remember, if you have a translation other than King James, you may not see the word servant, and therefore you may not see the same adjective that we see. And so we want to try to get these. But the next one we go to is in Luke. This is number 3. We're going to go to Luke chapter 16. Right? Now, the focal point is in verse 13. The focal point is in verse 13. Luke 16, verse 13. But we got to go get a little context for this before we let this all go. Let's go ahead and look at the focal verse, get a couple of things up here, and then we can begin to work on this. My translation, no servant can be the slave of two masters. He will either hate the first and love the second, or be attached to the first and despise the second. You cannot be the slave both of God and of money. So what adjective would come to mind here? This is one where you might have to look a bit or parse through the verse. You can be the slave of one master. That's what the verse says if you turn
loyal
it.
Loyal.
Loyal or loyalty. Okay. Loyal or loyalty. What does that word imply about an attitude?
Focus on God's will.
More than that.
Not going to be swayed.
Let me read this thing again. No servant can be the slave of two masters. So what's the attitude? Loyalty to one master. And that's about as simple as it can get. There's some of these that are a little harder to see, some a little easier. This one I think is a little easier. What have we got? Setting priorities, things of that sort, I think are implied by that. Now, how many of you have already been to the worship service? That's enough. What's the verse? Colossians 3:23. What did the verse say? If you're going to work on something, work on it with all your heart. And then it said what else? He didn't read the second half until well into the sermon. What was the rest of it? Working for God, not for human beings. It's essentially that echo that's coming out here. It's essentially that echo that's coming out here. Okay. Working. Deciding who it is you're working for. Interestingly enough, that little section or sections like it in the New Testament are very often aimed at slaves. People who were in a position where they had to work for a human being said, when you work for a human master, think of yourself as working for Christ. Do the things that you have to do in that regard. Now, there is an interesting section of scripture in the chapter 16 of Luke prior to this verse, and I'll simply commend it to you. This is, I think, one of the oddest of Jesus' parables. I think it tells an interesting story, but I don't want to go there for the context. I want to go someplace else. We are invited by T.W. Hunt to go to Genesis. And since that's about as far away as you can get from the New Testament, that seems like a good place to go. So see if you can find Genesis chapter 39. As you find Genesis 39, back up to 37 for just a moment and look at verse 2. And I want to just read the first little phrase. Look in Genesis 37, verse 2. And read maybe until the first period. In my case, that's about 6 or 7 words. What does it say? This is the account of, this is the story of. That's verse 1. This is verse 2. Interesting. Mine says, for verse 1, Jacob settled in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. And then verse 2, this is the story of Joseph. Joseph was 17 years old. How interesting.
But the next thing says, Joseph was 17.
Yeah, Joseph was 17. Okay. Whatever yours says, this is the story of Joseph. Chapter 37 tells that. Okay? Chapter 37 begins that story. When you get to the end of 37, what has happened to Joseph? The last verse of 37, what I'm hoping this is works. He had been sold. Now, in the verses just before, what's happened to his father? His father is plunged into deep grief. He thinks his kid is dead. They've taken some blood, put it on his clothes, and said an animal got him. They didn't have DNA. Okay, now, skip verse 38, chapter 38, because that's something else. Chapter 39 picks up the story of Joseph again. And according to T.W. Hunt, we're supposed to look at chapter 39, chapter 40, and chapter 41. Well, we can read it or we can talk about it, but we can't do both. I propose to talk about it for a little bit because I think some of you will remember enough of this story. What happens to Joseph, verse 1 of chapter 39, when he gets where the slave traders are taking him? He gets and sent into Potiphar's house. Who's Potiphar? Verse 1, chapter 39. One of Pharaoh's officers and commander of the guard, captain of the guard. Okay? Now, what happens to him in Potiphar's house? He was very, very successful at everything he did and was rapidly promoted until he was in charge of the whole house. And the Bible says in so many words, Potiphar would come home and eat his lunch, and that was about all he had to do with running of the house. He trusted everything to Joseph. At which point, Mrs. Potiphar said, "You're cute." And all of a sudden, there's a crisis for Joseph. And I heard somebody very wise one time say, if you try to figure out what you're going to do when you're in the middle of the crisis, it's too late. What's Joseph's response to her? I can't do it because it would be wrong. I can't do it because it would be wrong to your husband who has entrusted me. And I can't do it because it would be wrong to God. And he had a threefold loyalty, a loyalty to what is right, a loyalty to the person for whom he worked, and a loyalty to God whom he served. What did that bring to him? He was thrown into prison. Where was that prison? I think I'm right on this. Where was that prison? You have to look for it, but I think this is right. And since I don't remember exactly where it is, I won't tell you. Okay. But he was put into the jail. Into the king's prison. Uh-huh. But later on in another place in Genesis, there's this hint of where that place was. It was in the home of the commander of the guard. Anybody told you that? I think that's right. He basically went to the dungeon in this mansion that Potiphar would have had. I believe that's right. And there he stayed until what happened? He began to interpret dreams, but every time he interpreted dreams, he was always very careful to say, I'm not doing the interpretation, I'm just reporting to you what God said. And out of this came what? He not only came out of jail, what did he do? He ended up saving Egypt because he understood the king's dream to talk about famine coming. And the king put him in charge of the whole of the country. The status he had in Potiphar's house, he suddenly had in the whole of Egypt. And in the long run, what did that do? It brought salvation to Jacob's family back up in Israel. Because when the famine hit there, they came and had food. What was his statement at the end of his life? When his brother said, okay, our father's dead, now you're going to kill us. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. What did he say? You meant it to me for evil, but God meant it for good. Okay? What does this free God to do? What does loyalty to God free God to do? T.W. Hunt brought out something that I don't think I would have seen. What he said was, protect us. Loyalty to God brings a kind of protection. He still ended up in jail. And some of God's people have been killed. But in the protection, he promotes us. There's protection and there's promotion. Now, I want you to notice how these three are all pointing towards something. God makes himself revealed to us. He begins to do mighty things. And what does he do? He does those mighty things through us. There was an army of 300 left with Gideon. It didn't go to zero. God works through people to promote them. Now, I don't think that that's coincidental, and I don't think this is coincidental either. Humility leading to obedience, leading to loyalty, God manifesting himself, leading him doing mighty things, and doing mighty things in a way that we become a part of that and become significant out of that. He uses another word here that maybe is worth talking about. He speaks of this as devotion to God. And once you hit that theme, there's probably 20 places or 30 places he could have gone in Scripture to illustrate this. But he went to Joseph. Okay?
I noticed he was not taking credit for being able to interpret those dreams, too. He was giving God credit.
I think that's a very significant aspect of what was happening with Joseph, that people who are looking for credit, they'll get credit. You said people who want to be seen of men for the things they do, they'll get their reward, the reward they want, but they won't get the reward that matters.
He got that promotion because of his giving God the reward.
Yeah. The debates are on. Are you all watching any of those? We almost force our political leaders to promote themselves. We almost do not leave room for any other way to bring leadership to the fore. And remember I told you I was reading about Lincoln. Lincoln won the Republican nomination in 1860, and nobody expected him to do it. He came out of nowhere and became a compromise candidate after the leaders weren't able to put together a majority. So there's now a campaign between the nomination and the election. Would you care to guess how many political speeches Lincoln gave in that period of time?
Two.
Zero. His comment was, there's nothing I can say that would not be misunderstood, misconstrued, and used against me. I just let other people talk for me, and he went at hiding. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? It's an interesting story. Our political landscape has changed. It's a thought. It's a thought. Okay, let's move to number four. Let's move to number four. No, let's not do that yet. There's a term that you will hear, divided loyalty. What does that mean? Trying to serve two masters. How does that work? Not very well. Why not? Because you end up with demands over here that are inconsistent with expectations over there. You end up with demands over there that are inconsistent with expectations over here. You get torn apart. Pay attention a little bit to what Travis Collins says this morning. I got a feeling he's talking at least in part about some aspects of that. Okay, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. This is the next one. We're going to read the first two verses. Read the first two verses and tell me what the adjective is that we ought to put up here. Faithful is one translation, trustworthy is another. Okay. Is there any other adjective that you guys are getting? My translation doesn't use the word faithful, it uses the word trustworthy. People should think of us as Christ's servant, verse 1 reads, 1 Corinthians 4. Stewards entrusted with the mysteries of God. That's where King James would have said servants. Stewards entrusted with the mysteries of God. In such a matter, what is expected of stewards is that each one should be found trustworthy. Now he goes on to talk about the evaluation process. Those of you who've been in any kind of situation recently, in academics or in business, there's almost always now a big push for accountability and a big push for evaluation. And one of the questions is, what do we evaluate and what do you do with what you get out of that? And I think he's actually talking about that a little bit. The evaluation belongs to God, not to human beings. And he's careful to talk about that. What is expected of stewards or servants is that each one should be found faithful or trustworthy. Okay? Now, what attitude of mind emerges from this characteristic? I think I'm finally about to say it right. What attitude of mind emerges from this characteristic?
Clear conscience.
Okay.
Clear conscience.
Dependability would seem to me to be, you can depend on a person like this. Dependability might be there. What else? T.W. Hunt says this one. He says, confidence. Because faithfulness or trustworthiness as a servant of God implies a confidence that God has a plan, that his plan is ongoing, and that his plan will continue. And that my faithfulness becomes a part of that plan. Confidence in God's plan and confidence in God's plan continuing. Okay? So, what does this enable God to do? And we're back to Travis Collins' sermon this morning. Watch and let's see. If you haven't been yet, don't worry about it. If you have been, we're not giving away too much. Matthew 25. You got to keep an eye on this particular verse because it's going to come back later as one of the characteristics. And so if you notice a characteristic in here, that's fine. Just hold on to it. We'll get back to it later. But start looking at verse 14, verse 15, verse 16. What's this the story of? Jesus is telling a parable. The parable of the talents. Okay? A man was about to go abroad. He summoned his servants and he entrusted his property to them. He entrusted his property to them. That's where the connection comes. To one he gave 5 talents. That's a certain amount of money. To another 2. To a third 1. Each in proportion to his ability. I don't know that I had noticed that before in a way that I remembered it. Each in proportion to his ability. Then he set out on his journey. What the guy with 5 talents do? Invested them, traded with them, I think it says in one translation. With what result? He got 5 more. What about the fellow with 2? Same thing. He took 2 and turned it into 4. What about the guy with 1? Dug a hole in the ground, buried it. When the master came back, here you have what is yours. What was the king's or the master's response to the first 2? Because that's the answer to what does this free God to do? I want you to take a look at verse 21 and verse 23 because they are very, very similar. Verse 21, he speaks to the person who had had 5 and turned it into 10. Verse 23, he speaks to the one who had 2 and turned it into 4. What does he say? Well done. King James says, good and faithful. Mine says, good and trustworthy servant, because that's the term my translation is using. You have shown you are faithful or trustworthy in small things, so what? I will trust you with greater things. What's this free God to do? T.W. Hunt says, expand our ministry. Expand our ministry. when you look for somebody to take on a task, how do you go about choosing someone if you're a leader and need to delegate?
Somebody
to whom do you delegate it? Somebody you think is going to do it. And how do they show you that they're likely to do that task? They've done some other task in a faithful and trustworthy way. Okay? That's human nature. That's also spiritual truth. There is a joy that comes in being able to do more than you did before. There's a burnout that comes with doing too much. I think the pastor made some comment about that. I read the monthly newsletter that comes to the house. Have you guys read that? They had a lopping off party, apparently, and he used that word this morning. I don't know if you recognized it when he used that word. Okay, lopping off party. I suppose then the implication is that you can expand your ministry more than God really meant for it to be expanded. Maybe that's what it's saying. Just for fun, what if you have somebody the opposite of this? What's going to happen? You entrust them with something and it doesn't get done, or it gets done in a way that's unsatisfactory.
I think it reflects on God, maybe the church.
That was certainly the message. That was certainly the message of the morning. But there's one more thing that happens. What else happens? Life starts to restrict. Life starts to close in. The things you're able to do becomes smaller and smaller. So let's back up one. What happens when we don't have a loyalty to God, when we have divided loyalties, when we do that? What happens? The kinds of things God could do through us don't happen. Okay, I think we've got, yeah.
Question. In both of these examples, the people, the servants invested and made money, made whatever.
Yeah.
What if the person would have invested and lost? What kind of response do you think he would have had?
That's an excellent question. I know what I would say to that question, but I don't think it would be helpful to say it yet.
Oh.
What do you say?
He could be appreciative that they tried.
No guts, no glory, I think is the term I remember, the cliche I remember. Okay, what do you think?
He would have still been obedient.
I think there's about four answers, and I think this is the first one. Right? Are you lifting your hand for her? I noticed where the hand appeared. It was off of her right shoulder.
There are more ways to be rewarded than financially. They may have been rewarded in other ways. Yeah. Okay.
God teaches through losses as well as gains.
Yes, he does.
We have to obey whatever he said.
Because we can't always see what if there's a success. God may see a success in something that's going to show up much later. And so maybe our eyes are seeing what she's saying. I know we're not talking about just money now. We may not see something that we've invested in somebody. They may come after we're all dead and gone. I don't know how to explain it.
When you said that, I thought years ago I knew a missionary in North Africa. She was British. And she worked for years and years. She was faithful. Nobody came to Christ, but she came back. And now there is a Christian that we see.
Anybody else? The only answer I know to give to that is that Jesus made a statement that said, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?" And couple that with the evidence, like what Judith just talked about, that many of us will have heard examples of, of how the faithfulness of some person was not rewarded during that person's lifetime or during that person's work period, but became evident later. I think if we are loyal to God, God will work through us. I think if we are faithful and trustworthy, God will bring profit to the kingdom out of that, but it may not be monetary. I do think the idea of risking for the Lord is a piece of what the Bible teaches. And I think the Bible teaches also that people who risk can lose what the world seems to value. There's a section in Hebrews. Have you seen this lately? I don't know if you have. Turn to Hebrews just a second. Hebrews 11 is the great chapter on faith. If you come down to verse 32 of Hebrews 11, you can hear the writer saying, well, if I really start talking about all the things I ought to talk about, I'm going to run out of room and I'm going to run out of time. He says, what more shall I say that just isn't time for me to give an account of? And who's the first one he mentions? Gideon or Barak or Samson or Jephthah or David or Samuel or the prophets. Now listen to the description. These were the men who through faith conquered kingdoms, did what was upright, and earned the promises. They could keep a lion's mouth shut, put out blazing fires, and emerge unscathed from battle. They were weak people who were given strength to be brave in war and drive back foreign invaders. Now, in my mind, there is a break that occurs right there, and what follows is radically different. See if you can hear the difference. Some returned to their wives from the dead by resurrection. Others submitted to torture, refusing release so that they would rise again to a better life. Some had to bear being pilloried and flogged or even chained up in prison. They were stoned or sawn in half or killed by the sword. They were homeless and wore only the skins of sheep and goats. They were in want. They were in hardship. They were maltreated. They were too good for the world, and they wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and ravines. They all won acknowledgement through their faith. The ones who were successful by the world standards and the ones who were failures by the world standards. But they did not receive what was promised, since God had made provision for us to have something better, and they were not to receive that provision to reach perfection except along with us. Sometimes by the world standards, people can be failures. I think by God's standards, no one is ever a failure who works for Him. We got time for one more? Let's try it. Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. Start at verse 35. See that you have your belts done up and your lamps lit. Be like people waiting for their master to return from the wedding feast, ready to open the door as soon as he comes and knocks. Ready to open the door as soon as he comes and knocks. Blessed are those servants whom the master finds awake when he comes. In truth, I tell you, he will do up his belt. Sit them down at table and wait on them. It may be in the second watch that he comes or in the third, but blessed are those servants if he finds them ready. What's the message? What's the answer? Prepared. He uses the word watchful. I think you could use the word ready as well. What's the attitude that this implies?
Alert.
Mm-hmm. He uses the word attentive. To the master's voice or call. Now, what does that free God to do? He takes you to answer that question. T.W. Hunt takes you to Habakkuk. Is there anybody who knows what it is in Habakkuk almost instantly that he might be taking you to? Well, I thought maybe not, but we'll see. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 1. The prophet speaks, I will stand at my post, I will station myself on my watchtower, watching to see what he will say to me, what answer he will give to my complaints. Now the context for this is awful, but the point is clear. What does this do? It frees God to do what? To speak to us. Now, I think there's a similarity between the first one and this one. God reveals himself to us. We begin to see things about God. But in this one, we begin to hear God speaking directly and specifically to us. Now, let's see where we are here. Humility opens God to begin to reveal him, frees God to begin to reveal himself to us. Obedience frees God to do mighty things. Loyalty frees God to promote us in that process. Faithfulness and trustworthiness brings us to the ability that God can entrust us with more and more things in his work. And we can begin to join in God's happiness as we do that. And if we're prepared and watchful and ready and attentive, then God can speak. God's presence comes early. God's voice comes late in this list. I don't know if T.W. Hunt set it up that way, but I think there's something probably right about that. We are called to be God's servants. Servants ought to be humble, obedient, loyal, faithful, and watchful. And when those things come in the life of one of God's followers, it frees God to do things that only God can do. And not only does that change the world, that brings a kind of joy that it can't be measured. I want to say Happy New Year to each of you. Let's have a word of prayer as we go, as we close. Our Father, in this year that's coming, we understand that we are called on to be your servants. The work that we are called on to do in the world is work that connects to our call from you to be part of your kingdom in this world. And so today I pray that in this year to come, all of us can be faithful. All of us can be loyal. All of us can be watchful and humble and obedient. That we can begin to take on the characteristics of servanthood that we saw in your Son. And that because we do, you can begin to work through us more and more. And in that way, we can find your joy and share that joy with you. I pray all of this for all of us. In your Son's name. Amen.
My mind.